content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. In the April 15, 2010 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Jean Michaud wrote the following. Reviewing Jorge Luis Borges' The Book of Imaginary Beings in the New Yorker in 1970, George Steiner wrote, like Lewis Carroll, Borges has made of autistic dreams, of a private condition that is exotic and idiosyncratic to a degree, pictures, discreet but exacting summonses that readers the world over are discovering with a sense of perfect recognition. Our streets and gardens, the arrowing of a lizard across the warm light, our libraries and circular staircases are beginning to look precisely as Borges imagined them. Borges, a librarian by profession, was born in Buenos Aires in 1899. Though he began publishing his surreal fantastical works in Argentina in the 1920s, it was not until the 1960s when his book Ficciones, written in 1944, was translated, that he became widely read outside the Spanish-speaking world. Beginning in 1967, Borges published more than 60 poems and stories in The New Yorker, including several posthumously. In a review of Ficciones in our pages in 1962, Naomi Bliven noted, one way or another, Borges constantly takes issue with reality, or what the common sense consensus calls reality, such as our unprovable, ineradicable beliefs in causality or in the relevance of what we perceive to what exists or in our own being. And now, from the January 7th, 1967 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Aleph, by Jorge Luis Borges. Oh God, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space. Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2. But they will teach us that eternity is the standing still of the present time, a nunc stans, as the schools call it, which neither they nor any else understand, no more than they would a hic stans for an infinite greatness of place. From Leviathan, Part 4, Chapter 46. On the incandescent February morning, Beatrice Viterbo died, after a death agony so imperious it did not for a moment descend into sentimentalism or fear. I noticed that the iron billboards in the Plaza Constitucion bore new advertisements for some brand or other of Virginia tobacco. I was saddened by this fact, for it made me realize that the incessant and vast universe was already moving away from her, and that this change was the first in an infinite series. The universe would change, but I would not, I thought with melancholy vanity. I knew that sometimes my vain devotion had exasperated her. Now that she was dead, I could consecrate myself to her memory without hope, but also without humiliation. I thought of how the 30th of April was her birthday, to visit her house in Calle Garde on that day and pay my respects to her father and Carlos Argentino Danieri, her first cousin, would be an act of courtesy, irreproachable, and perhaps even unavoidable. I would wait, once again, in the twilight of the overladen entrance hall. I would study, one more time, the particulars of her numerous portraits, Beatrice Viterbo in her profile, in color. Beatrice wearing a mask during the Carnival of 1921. Beatrice at her first communion. Beatrice on the day of her wedding to Roberto Alessandri. Beatrice a little while after the divorce, at a dinner in the club Hippico. Beatrice with Delia San Marco Porcel and Carlos Argentino. Beatrice with the Pekingese, which had been a present from Villegas Haido. Beatrice from the front and in a three-quarter view, smiling, her hand under her chin. I would not be obliged, as on other occasions, to justify my presence with moderate-priced offerings of books, with books whose pages finally I learned to cut beforehand, so as to avoid finding, months later, that they were still uncut. Beatrice Viterbo died in 1929. From that time on, I never let a 30th of April go by without a visit to her house. I used to arrive there around 7:15 and stay about 25 minutes. Every year, I came a little later and stayed a little longer. In 1933, a torrential rain worked to my advantage. They were forced to invite me to dine. I did not fail to avail myself of this advantageous precedent. In 1934, I appeared just after 8 with a honey nut cake from Santa Fe. With the greatest naturalness, I remained for supper. And thus, on these melancholy and vainly erotic anniversaries, Carlos Argentino Daneri began gradually to confide in me. Beatrice was tall, fragile, lightly leaning forward. There was in her walk, if the oxymoron is acceptable, a kind of gracious torpor, the beginnings of an ecstasy. Carlos Argentino is rosy, important, gray-haired, fine-featured. He holds some subordinate position or other in a library in the Southside suburbs. He is authoritarian, but also ineffective. Until very recently, he took advantage of nights and holidays to avoid going out of his house. At a remove of two generations, the Italian S and the copious gesticulation of the Italians survive in him. His mental activity is continuous, impassioned, versatile, and altogether insignificant. He abounds in useless analogies and fruitless scruples. He possesses, as did Beatrice, long, lovely, tapering hands. For several months, he was obsessed with Paul Fort, less with his ballads than with the idea of irreproachable glory. "He is the prince of the poets of France," he would repeat fatuously. "You will set yourself against him in vain. No, not even your most poisoned barb will reach him." The 30th of April, 1941, I allowed myself to add to the gift of honey, nut cake, a bottle of Argentine cognac. Carlos Argentino tasted it, judged it interesting, and after a few glasses launched on a vindication of modern man. "I evoke him," he said with rather inexplicable animation, "in his studio laboratory, in the city's watchtower, so to say, supplied with telephones, telegraphs, phonographs, radio telephone apparatus, cinema equipment, magic lanterns, glossaries, timetables, compendiums, bulletins." He remarked that for a man of such faculties, the act of travel was useless. Our 20th century had transformed the fable of Mohammed and the mountain. The mountains now converged upon the modern Mohammed. His ideas seemed so inept to me, their exposition so pompous and so vast, that I immediately related them to literature. I asked him why he did not write them down. Foreseeably, he replied that he had already done so. These concepts, and others no less novel, figured in the augural canto, or more simply, the prologue canto, of a poem on which he had been working for many years, without publicity, without any deafening to-do, putting his entire reliance on those two props known as work and solitude. First, he opened the floodgates of the imagination, and then he made use of a sharp file. The poem was titled The Earth. It consisted of a description of the planet, wherein naturally there was no lack of picturesque digression and elegant apostrophe. I begged him to read me a passage, even though brief. He opened a drawer in his desk, took out a tall bundle of pages from a pad, each sheet stamped with the letterhead of the Juan Crisostomo Lafinure Library, and with sonorous satisfaction read out, "I have seen, like the Greek, the cities of men and their fame, their labor, days of various light, hunger's shame. I correct no event, falsify no name, but the voyage I narrate is a tour de de ma chambre. By all lights, an interesting strophe, he opined. The first line wins the applause of the professor, the academician, the Hellenist, if not of superficial pedants, who form, these last, a considerable sector of public opinion. The second passes from Homer to Hesiod, the entire verse an implicit homage writ on the facade of the resplendent building to the father of didactic poetry, not without rejuvenating a procedure whose lineage goes back to scripture, that of enumeration, congeries, or conglomeration. The third line, baroquism, decadentism, purified and fanatical cult of form, is composed of two twin hemistich. The fourth, frankly bilingual, assures me the unconditional support of every spirit sensitive to the gay lure of graceful play. I say nothing of the rare rhyme, nor of the learning which permits me, without any pedantry, to accumulate in four lines three erudite allusions encompassing 30 centuries of compressed literature. First to the Odyssey, second to Works and Days, third to the immortal bagatelle proffered us through the idling of the Savoyard's pen. Once more I have understood that modern art requires the balsam of laughter, the scherzo. Decidingly, Goldoni has the floor. He read me many another stanza, each of which obtained his approbation and profuse commentary, too. There was nothing memorable in any of them. I did not even judge them very much worse than the first one. There had been a collaboration in his writing between application, resignation, and chance. The virtues which De Neri attributed to them were posterior. I realized that the poet's labor lay not with the poetry, but with the invention of reasons to make the poetry admirable. Naturally, this ulterior and subsequent labor modified the work for him, but not for others. Donati's oral style was extravagant. His metric heaviness hindered his transmitting that extravagance, except in a very few instances, to the poem. I recall, nevertheless, the following lines from a satire in which he harshly fustigated bad poets. This one gives his poem bellicose armorings of erudition that one puts in pomp and jubilee. Both in vain beat their ridiculous wings, forgetting the wretches, the factor, beauty. Only the fear of creating for himself an army of implacable and powerful foes dissuaded him, he told me, from fearlessly publishing this poem. Only once in my life have I had occasion to examine the 15,000 dodecasyllabic verses of the Polyolbion, that topographic epic poem in which Michael Drayton recorded the flora, fauna, hydrography, orography, military, and monastic history of England. I am sure that this considerable but limited production is less tedious than the vast congeneric enterprise of Carlos Argentino. The latter proposed to put into verse the entire face of the planet. In 1941, he had already dispatched several hectares of the state of Queensland, in addition to 1 kilometer of the course of the River Obe, a gasometer north of Veracruz, the main business houses in the parish of La Concepcion, the villa owned by Mariana Cambraceres de Alvear on 11th of September Street in Belgrano, and an establishment devoted to Turkish baths, not far from the famous Brighton Aquarium. He read me from his poem certain laborious passages concerning the Australian zone, and these large and formless Alexandrines lacked the relative agitation of the preface. I copy 1 stanza. Know ye, to the right hand of the routinary post, coming, of course, from the north-northwest, one wearies out a skeleton, color, white celeste, which gives the sheep run an ossuary cast. 2 audacious strokes, he cries out in exultation, redeemed, I can hear you muttering, by success. I admit it, I admit it. 1, the epithet, routinary, which accurately proclaims en passant the inevitable tedium inherent in pastoral and farming chores, a tedium which neither Georgic poetry nor our already laureled Don Segundo ever ventured to denounce in this way in red-hot heat. The other, the energetic prosaicism of one wearies out a skeleton, a phrase which the prudish will want to excommunicate in horror, but which the critic will, with viral taste, will appreciate more than his life. For the rest, the entire line is of high carat, the highest. The second hemistich engages the reader in the most animated converse. It anticipates his lively curiosity, places a question in his mouth, and answers it instantly. And what do you tell me of that find of mine, White Celeste? This picturesque neologism insinuates the sky, which is a very important factor in the Australian landscape. Without this evocation, the colors of the sketch would be much too somber, and the reader would find himself compelled to close the book, wounded in the innermost part of his soul by a black and incurable melancholy. Toward midnight, I took my leave. Two Sundays later, Denari called me on the telephone, for the first time in his life, I believe. He proposed that we meet at 4 o'clock to drink a glass of milk together in the salon bar next door, which the progressivism of Zunino and Zungri, the proprietors of my house, you will recall, is causing to be inaugurated on the corner. Truly a confectionery shop you will be interested in knowing about. I accepted, with more resignation than enthusiasm. There was no difficulty in finding a table. The salon bar, inexorably modern, was just slightly less atrocious than what I had foreseen. At the neighboring tables, an excited public mentioned the sums which Zunino and Zungri had invested without batting an eye. Carlos and Argentino feigned astonishment over some wonder or other in the lighting installations, which he doubtless already knew about, and he said to me with a certain severity, "You'll have to admit, no matter how grudgingly, that these premises vie successfully with the most renowned of Flores." Then he reread me 4 or 5 pages of his poem. He had made corrections in accordance with a depraved principle of verbal ostentation, where he had formerly written Azurish, he now put Azuritic, Azuritish, and even Azuri. The word lacteus proved not ugly enough for him. In the course of an impetuous description of a wool washer, he preferred lactery, lactinus, and lactescent, and lactiferous. He bitterly reviled the critics. Later, in a more benign spirit, he compared them to persons, quote, who dispose of no precious metals, nor steam presses, nor rolling presses, nor sulfuric acids fermenting treasures, but who can indicate to others the site of a treasure, end quote. Next, he censored prologomania, which the Prince of Talents in the graceful prefacing of the Don Quixote already ridiculed. He nevertheless admitted to me now that by way of frontispiece to the new work, a showy prologue, an accolade signed by the feather pen of a bird of prey, of a man of weight, would be most convenient. He added that he planned to bring out the initial cantos of his poem. I believed I understood then the singular telephonic invitation. The man was going to ask me to preface his pedantic farrago. My fears proved unfounded. Carlos Argentino observed, with rancorous admiration, that he did not misuse the epithet into denominating as solid the prestige achieved in all circles by Alvaro Melian Lafinur, man of letters, who would, if I insisted on it, delightfully prologue the poem. So, as to avoid the most unpardonable of failures, I was to make myself spokesman for two undeniable merits, formal perfection and scientific rigor. Quote, inasmuch as this vast garden of tropes, figures of speech, and elegance allows no single detail which does not confirm the severe truth, end quote. He added that Beatrice had always enjoyed herself with Alvaro. I assented profusely. For greater conviction, I promised to speak to Alvaro on Thursday, rather than wait until the following Monday. We could meet at the small supper that usually climaxes every reunion of the Writers' Club. There are no such suppers, but it is an irrefutable fact that the reunions do take place on Thursdays, a point which Carlos Argentino Daneri would find confirmed in the daily newspapers, and which lent a certain reality to the phrase. Adopting an air halfway between divinatory and sagacious, I told him that before taking up the question of a prologue, I would delineate the curious plan of the book. And we took our leave of each other. As I turned the corner in the Calle Bernardo de Irigoyen, I impartially considered the alternatives before me. A, I could talk to Avaro and tell him how that cousin of Beatrice's, this explicatory euphemism would allow me to say her name, had elaborated a poem which seemed to dilate to infinity the possibilities of cacophony and chaos. B, I could fail to speak to Alvaro altogether. I foresaw lucidly that my indolence would choose B. From early Friday morning, the telephone began to disquiet me. It made me indignant to think that this instrument, which in other days had produced an irrecoverable voice of Beatrice, could lower itself to being a receptacle for the useless and perhaps even choleric complaints of that deceived man, Carlos Argentino Daneri. Luckily, nothing awful occurred, except the inevitable animosity inspired by that man, who had imposed on me a delicate mission and would later forget me altogether. The telephone lost its terrors, but then, toward the end of October, Carlos Argentino called me again. He was terribly agitated. At first, I could not identify the voice. Sadly, and yet wrathfully, he stammered that the now uncurbed Zunanino and Zungari, under the pretext of enlarging their outrageous confectionery, were going to demolish his house. "The house of my fathers! The house, the inveterate house of the Calle Garay!" he went on repeating, perhaps forgetting his grief in the melody. It was not difficult for me to share his grief. Once one is past 40, every change is a detestable symbol of the passage of time. Besides, at stake was a house that, for me, infinitely alluded to Beatrice. I wanted to bring out this most delicate point. My interlocutor did not hear me. He said that if Zunino and Zungari persisted in their absurd proposal, Dr. Zuni, his lawyer, would enter an action ipso facto for damages and would oblige them to pay 100,000 pesos nacionales in compensation. I was impressed to hear the name of Zuni. His practice, out of his office at the corner of Caseros and Tacuari, was of a proverbial and solemn reliability. I asked if Zuni had already taken charge of the matter. Daneri said he would speak to him that very afternoon. He hesitated, and then, in that level, impersonal voice to which we all have recourse for confiding something very intimate, he told me that in order to finish the poem, the house was indispensable to him, for in one of the cellar corners there was an aleph. He indicated that an aleph is one of the points in space containing all points. "It's in the dining room cellar," he explained, his diction growing hasty from anxiety. It's mine. I discovered it in childhood, before I was of school age. The cellar stair is steep, and my aunt and uncle had forbidden me to go down it. But someone said that there was a world in the cellar. They were referring, I found out later, to a trunk. But I understood there was a world there. I descended secretly, went rolling down the forbidden stairs, fell off. When I opened my eyes, I saw the aleph. "The aleph?" I echoed. "Yes, the place where, without any possible confusion All the places in the world are found, seen from every angle. I revealed my discovery to no one, and I returned there. The child could not understand that this privilege was proffered him so that the man might chisel out the poem. Zunino and Zungri will not dislodge me. No, 1,000 times no. With the code of laws in hand, Dr. Zuni will prove that my Aleph is inalienable. I attempted to reason with him, but isn't the cellar very dark? Really, truth does not penetrate a rebellious understanding. If all the places on earth are in the Aleph must also contain all the illuminations, all the lights, all the sources of light. Well, I will go and see it at once. I hung up before he could issue a prohibition. The knowledge of one fact is enough to allow one to perceive at once a whole series of confirming traits previously unsuspected. I was astonished not to have understood until that moment that Carlos Argentino was a madman. All the Viterbos, for that matter. Beatrice, I often say most so myself, was a woman, a girl, of an almost implacable clairvoyance. But there was about her a negligence, a distraction, a disdain, a real cruelty, which perhaps called for a pathological explanation. The madness of Carlos Argentino filled me with malicious felicity in our innermost beings. We had always detested each other. In Calle Garé, the serving woman asked me if I would be kind enough to wait. The child was, as always, in the cellar, developing photographs. Next to the flower vase, without a single flower in it, atop the useless piano, there smiled, more timeless than anachronic, the great portrait of Beatrice in dull colors. No one could see us. In an access of tender despair, I went up close and told her, "Beatrice, Beatrice, Elena, Beatrice, Elena Viterbo, beloved Beatrice, Beatrice, lost forever. It is I, Borges." A little later, Carlos came in. He spoke with a certain dryness. I understood that he was incapable of thinking of anything but the loss of the Aleph. "A glass of the pseudo-cognac," he ordered, "and then you can duck into the cellar. As you already know, the dorsal decupitus is imperative, and so are darkness, immobility, and a certain ocular accommodation. You lie down on the tile floor and fix your eyes on the 18th step of the pertinent stairs. I leave, lower the trapdoor, and you're alone. Quite likely, it should be easy. Some rodent will scare you. In a few minutes, you will see the Aleph. The microcosm of alchemists and cabalists, our proverbial concrete friend, the multum in parvo." Once we were in the dining room, he added, "Of course, if you don't see it, your incapacity in no way invalidates my testimony. Now, down with you. Very shortly, you will be able to engage in a dialogue with all of the images of Beatrice." I rapidly descended, tired of his insubstantial words. The cellar, barely wider than the stairs, had much of a well about it. I gazed about in search of the trunk in which Carlos Argentino had spoken. Some cases with bottles in them and some canvas bags cluttered one corner. Carlos picked up one of the bags, folded it in half, and placed it exactly in a precise spot. "A humble pillow," he explained. "But if I raise it 1 centimeter, you won't see a thing, and you'll be left abashed and ashamed. Stretch your bulk out on the floor and count off 18 steps. I complied with his ridiculous requisites, and at last he went away. Carefully, he closed the trap door. The darkness, despite a crevice which I discovered later, seemed total. And suddenly I realized the danger I ran. I had allowed myself to be buried by a madman after having drunk some poison. Beyond the transparent bravado of Carlos was the intimate terror that I would not see the prodigy. to defend his delirium, to avoid knowing that he was mad. Carlos had to kill me. A confused malaise swept over me. I attempted to attribute it to my rigid posture rather than to the operation of a narcotic. I closed my eyes, opened them. Then I saw the Aleph. I arrive now at the ineffable center of my story. And here begins my despair as a writer. All language is an alphabet of symbols whose use presupposes a past shared by the other interlocutors. How then transmit to others the infinite Aleph, which my fearful mind scarcely encompasses? The mystics, in similar situations, are lavish with emblems. To signify the divinity, a Persian speaks of a bird that in some way is all birds. Alanus de Insulus speaks of a sphere whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. Ezekiel, of four angels with four faces, who look simultaneously to the Orient and the Occident, to the North and the South. Not vainly do I recall these inconceivable analogies. They bear some relation to the Aleph. Perhaps the gods would not be against my finding an equivalent image, but then this report would be contaminated with literature, with falsehood. For the rest, the central problem is unsolvable. The enumeration, even if only partial, of an infinite complex. In that gigantic instant, I saw millions of delightful and atrocious acts. None astonished me more than the fact that all of them together occupied the same point, without superimposition and without transparency. What my eyes saw was simultaneous. What I shall transcribe is successive because language is successive. Nevertheless, I shall cull something of it all. In the lower part of the step, toward the right, I saw a small iridescent sphere of almost intolerable brilliance. At first, I thought it rotary. Then I understood that this movement was an illusion produced by the vertiginous sights it enclosed. The Aleph's diameter must have been about 2 or 3 centimeters, but cosmic space was in it, without diminution of size. Each object, the mirror's glass, for instance, was infinite objects, for I clearly saw it from all points in the universe. I saw the heavy-laden sea. I saw the dawn and the dusk. I saw the multitudes of America. I saw a silver-plated cobweb at the center of a black pyramid. I saw a tattered labyrinth. It was London. I saw interminable eyes nearby, looking at me as if in a mirror. I saw all the mirrors in the planet, and none reflected me. In an inner patio in the Calle Soler, I saw the same paving tile I had seen 30 years before in the entranceway to a house in the town of Fray Bentos. I saw clusters of grapes, snow, tobacco, veins of metal, steam. I saw convex equatorial deserts and every grain of sand in them. I saw a woman at Inverness whom I shall not forget. I saw her violent switch of hair, her proud body, the cancer in her breast. I saw a circle of dry land on a sidewalk where formerly there had been a tree. I saw a villa in Androge. I saw a copy of the first English version of Pliny by Philemon Holland, and saw simultaneously every letter on every package. As a boy, I used to marvel that the letters in a closed hook did not get mixed up and lost in the course of a night. I saw night and day contemporaneously. I saw a sunset in Querétaro, which seemed to reflect the color of a rose in Bengal. I saw my bedroom with nobody in it. I saw in a study in Alkmaar a terraqueous globe between two mirrors which multiply it without end. I saw horses with swirling manes on a beach by the Caspian Sea at dawn. I saw the delicate bone structure of a hand. I saw the survivors of a battle sending out postcards. I saw a deck of Spanish playing cards in a shop window at Mirzapur. I saw the oblique shadows of some ferns on the floor of a hothouse. I saw tigers, imbali, bison, groundswells, and armies. I saw all the ants on earth. I saw a Persian astrolabe. In a desk drawer, I saw, the writing made me tremble, obscene, incredible, precise letters which Beatrice had written, Carlos Argentino. I saw an adored monument in La Chacarita Cemetery. I saw the atrocious relic of what deliciously had been Beatrice Viterbo. I saw the circulation of my obscure blood. I saw the gearing of love and the modifications of death. I saw the Aleph from all points. I saw the earth in the Aleph, and in the earth the Aleph once more. I saw my face and my viscera. I saw your face and felt vertigo and cried because my eyes had seen that conjectural and secret object whose name men usurp, but which no man has gazed on. The inconceivable universe. I felt infinite veneration, infinite compassion. You must be good and dizzy from peering into things that don't concern you, cried a hateful, jovial voice. Even if you rack your brains, you won't be able to pay me back in a century for this revelation. What a formidable observatory, eh, Borges? Carlos Argentino's feet occupied the highest step. In the half-light, I managed to get up and to stammer, "Formidable, yes, formidable." The indifference in the sound of my voice surprised me. Anxiously, Carlos Argentino insisted, "You saw it all? In colors?" It was at that instant that I conceived my revenge. Benevolently, with obvious pity, nervous, evasive, I thanked Carlos Argentino for the hospitality of his cellar and urged him to take advantage of the demolition of his house to get far away from the pernicious capital, which is easy on no one. Believe me, on no one. I refused with suave energy to discuss the Aleph. I embraced him on leaving and repeated that the country and its quiet are two grand doctors. In the street, on the Constitucion stairs, in the subway, all the faces struck me as familiar. I feared that not a single thing was left to cause me surprise. I was afraid I would never be quit of the impression that I had returned. Happily, at the end of a few nights of insomnia, forgetfulness worked in me again. P.S. March 1st, 1943. 6 months after the demolition of the building in Calle Garay, Procusto Publishers did not take fright at the length of Argentino's considerable poem and launched upon the reading public a selection of Argentino extracts. It is almost needless to repeat what happened. Carlos Argentino de Neri received second prize of the National Prizes for Literature. "I received your pained congratulations," he wrote me. "You huff and puff with envy, my lamentable friend, but you must confess, though you choke, that this time I was able to crown my bonnet with the reddest of feathers, to put in my turban the Caliph of Rubies." First prize was awarded to Dr. Aita, third to Dr. Mario Bonfanti. Incredibly, my book, The Cards of the Card Shop, did not get a single vote. Once again, incomprehension and envy won the day. For a long time now, I have not been able to see De Neri. The Daily Press says he will soon give us another volume. His fortunate pen, no longer benumbed by the Aleph, has been consecrated to versifying the epitomes of Dr. Acevedo Diaz. I would like to add two further observations. One, on the nature of the Aleph, the other on its name. All is well known. The latter is the name of the first letter of the alphabet of the sacred language. Its application to the cycle of my story does not appear mere chance. For the Kabbalah, this letter signifies the Ein Sof, the limitless and pure divinity. It has also been said that it has the form of a man who points out heaven and earth to indicate that the inferior world is the mirror and map of the superior. For the Mengenlehre, it is the symbol of transfinite numbers, in which the whole is no greater than any of its parts. I wanted to know, had Carlos Argentino chosen this name, or had he read it, applied to another point where all points converge, in some one of the innumerable texts revealed to him by the Aleph in his house? Incredible as it may seem, I believe there is, or was, another Aleph. I believe that the Aleph in the Kaye Gare was a false Aleph. Here are my reasons. Toward 1867, Captain Burton held the office of British consul in Brazil. In July 1942, Pedro Henriquez Ureña discovered, in a library at Santos, a manuscript by Burton dealing with the mirror which the Orient attributes to Iskandar Zu al-Karanyan or Alexander Birkornis of Macedonia. In its glass, the entire world was reflected. Burton mentions other artifices of like kind, the septuple goblet of Kai Khosrou, the mirror which Tariq bin Ziyad found in a tower, the 1001 Nights, page 272, the mirror which Lucian of Samosata was able to examine on the moon, True History, chapter 1, page 26, the diaphanous spear which the first book of Capella's Satyricon attributes to Jupiter, the universal mirror of Merlin, round and hollow, and seemed a world of glass, the Fairy Queen, chapter 3, pages 2 and 19. And he adds these curious words, but the former, besides the defect of not existing, are mere instruments of optics. The faithful who attend the Mosque of Amir in Cairo know very well that the universe is in the interior of one of the stone columns surrounding the central courtyard. No one, of course, can see it. But those who put their ears to the surface claim to hear within a short time its workaday rumor. The mosque dates from the 7th century. The columns come from other pre-Islamic temples. For as Ibn Khaldun has written, in republics founded by nomads, the assistance of foreigners is indispensable in all that concerns masonry. Does that Aleph exist in the innermost recess of a stone? Did I see it when I saw all things, and have I forgotten it? Our minds are porous with forgetfulness. I myself am falsifying and losing through the tragic erosion of the years, the features of Beatrice. And now from the personal history section of the June 19th, 2020 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, Growing Up with Juneteenth, How a Texan Holiday Became a National Tradition, by Annette Gordon Reed. When I was a little girl in Texas, I thought Juneteenth belonged to us, meaning to the state of Texas generally, and to black Texans specifically. In my small town, the story of Gordon Granger, the U.S. Army general who announced in Galveston on June 19, 1865, that slavery was over, was told with seriousness and bits of gallows humor. The older people joked that the Emancipation Proclamation had actually been signed 2 years before, but the white people wanted to get a few extra harvest season in before they told the Negroes about it. My father would say, with a sardonic smile and a short laugh, that it was worse than that, The slaves have never really been freed. The jokes played upon several basic truths. The Emancipation Proclamation had, in fact, been signed more than 2 years before, but its provisions could only be applied in areas controlled by the U.S. Army. Confederate forces in Texas did not surrender until June 2, 1865. Even after Granger's announcement, many whites in Texas continued to enslave people who had not heard the news. Those who had heard were often forcibly prevented from acting as if any material change had taken place. Freedom had come in legal terms, but the story was not so clear on the ground as it was on paper. Former enslavers unleashed violence upon the people whom they had claimed as property, and others threatened to do so in order to make people work. Amid joy and hope was great malevolence and power. As my father's jibe suggested, the legacies of slavery still lingered, putting true freedom out of reach. I don't recall white Texans celebrating Juneteenth. Then again, I wouldn't know. The holiday was part of the summer, and summer took kids in my hometown out of the schools and back into our racially separated communities. For our part, Juneteenth meant drinking red soda water and eating barbecued goat, along with other traditional Southern dishes. I loved the red soda water part. I was not so much into eating goat. It was not just that I disliked the taste. Goat was not a usual part of the menu in my area, so if goat was to be had, one had to be killed and prepared, which I watched a neighbor do on one occasion to my horror. Whatever leanings I have toward vegetarianism grew out of watching a terrified animal as he was hung upside down, bleeding, just before his throat was slit. But that ritual was easily avoided, and we kids, our mouths red, spent most of our time playing games, throwing firecrackers, and lighting sparklers until night fell. The holiday we celebrated with whites, though seldom together, was the 4th of July. The difference between the 2 days was apparent to me even as a kid. Whites had much more reason to see the Declaration of Independence as the fulfillment of something, namely of their desire to create a nation over which they exercise control. From the country's earliest days, whites in the South, in particular, saw their freedom as inextricably linked to their power over African Americans, power that they maintained through legal and extra-legal means, even after slavery's end. The long effort to loosen that grip had been the project of black activists and their white allies during the second half of the 20th century. By the time of my early childhood, those efforts were just beginning to bear fruit. For blacks, the Declaration carried a promise not yet fulfilled. It was in this sense that Juneteenth and the 4th of July were, in fact, related. The words that Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration about equality echo in the executive order that Granger read that June from the villa where he was living. Quote, "The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain quietly at their present homes and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts, and that they will not be supported in idleness either, there or elsewhere." The Confederacy, of which Texas had been a part, had emphatically rejected the Declaration's language about equality. Indeed, in his famous Cornerstone speech from 1861, Alexander Stephens, the vice president of the Confederacy, called out Jefferson by name when he said, "Jefferson, in his forecast, had anticipated slavery as the rock upon which the old Union would split. He was right. The prevailing ideas entertained by him and most of the leading statesmen at the time of the formation of the old Constitution were that enslavement of the African was in violation of the laws of nature, that it was wrong in principle, socially, morally, and politically. These ideas, however, were fundamentally wrong. Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. As a child, I knew nothing of Stevens or his statement of the Confederacy's bedrock principles. But it is no wonder that such attitudes, so passionately felt and expressed, would pass down through generations in some white families and still remain resonant. And be familiar to me when I gained consciousness as part of a community outside of my family. Although important, Granger's reading of an executive order, an order based upon the will of a president already assassinated 2 months earlier by a man who feared black equality, was only a tiny step toward the work that had to be done. I also did not know, as a child, how intensely African Americans had fought to keep alive the memory of Juneteenth, to commemorate our ancestors' struggles and their hopes, and to link them to our own. As I grew older, I learned from my mother about Emancipation Park in nearby Houston. Emancipation Park is one of the oldest public parks in the state. It was founded in 1872 when four men who had been enslaved raised money from two churches and purchased 10 acres of land on which to hold Juneteenth celebrations. A few decades later, in the 1910s, the city gained control of the land and made it a segregated public park. On Juneteenth, black people gathered there in their Sunday's best to hear speeches and readings of the Emancipation Proclamation. All of this took place in the years of Jim Crow. Texas, with a smaller percentage of blacks than more notorious southern states like Mississippi or Alabama, was a very hard place. Between 1882 and 1968, it had the third highest numbers of lynchings in the United States. By the time I left for college, Juneteenth had become even more established in Texas, and I saw more instances of blacks and whites celebrating it together. Indeed, while I was home on Christmas break in 1980, it became an official state holiday. This amounted to a big admission in a state that had long framed itself as the land of wide open spaces and cowboys, instead of the land of mainly Anglo-American planters who had moved west out of Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, dragging enslaved people, my ancestors among them, to pick cotton, cut sugar cane, and fell trees in the piney woods of East Texas. Those same planters fought a war with Mexico, which had abolished slavery, to maintain their independence. We normally think of the enslaved running north. Enslaved people in Texas often ran south. Even before then, from my new vantage out in the world, it had begun to dawn on me that Juneteenth was not just an occasion for Texans to think of ourselves as special in the way we so like to do. I noticed that blacks around the country spoke of celebrating Juneteenth. I admit to being nonplussed at first, if not a tad resentful. What about Galveston? What about hiding the news to bring in two more harvests? What about the red soda water? That churlish attitude could not last, given the larger context in which the holiday was born. Black Texans had moved all over the country, carrying their traditions with them. It was fitting that their legacy was, in part, this celebration, which honored black humanity in the face of a powerful community that continued to reject it. Today, there is a strong movement to make Juneteenth a national holiday. If one thinks about it, it is staggering that there is no date commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. On the other hand, I know what my father, were he still alive, would have to say about that. Something about counting chickens before they hatch. I take his point. There is some danger that holidays allow us to become too self-congratulatory. So many, many awful things happened after Granger made his speech. So much violence and oppression. But I remember a conversation I had with my great-grandmother, whose own mother had been enslaved as a child. I offered, in an old soul kind of way, that it seemed to me that people were acting as if Juneteenth were no longer a big deal. Her eyes met mine. It was a big deal to us, she said. And now, from the June 2022 issue of The New Yorker, a poem, Figs, by Henri Cole. Overnight, the figs got moldy and look like little brains or ids without structure that say something dark about our species, not really laying down a garden, but living out the violent myths. An insect chorus, almost diaphanous, in a neighbor's yard, says something too. America began in tall ships that glowed from within, but for the wretched, it still wretchedeth every day. As the bright day goes round the sun, why do our days grow more aggressive and difficult? Why do the world's shadows come so close as its wonders beckon? Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.